Dmitry Samarov. Today I talked to the LA novelist Bruce Wagner about life in Hollywood, the vicissitudes of the publishing industry, and a whole lot more. So my first conversation with Bruce, I hope it will lead to many more.
How's your morning so far?
It's all right. This is very loud and clear.
Good. As long as we can hear each other, that's all that matters.
Okay.
Yeah. So you have a lot going on today. That's why it's better for you to do this earlier.
Yes. Yeah. And something canceled for me, which makes this much better.
Well, I'm glad. Is stuff starting to gear up for this new book? Or
Yeah.
That's good.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose it's good. I saw a photo online of there was a talk at Chateau Marmont, I think.
Yes. There was a talk. Yes. I did with my old friend Ed Ruscha.
How was that?
That was good. It was good. I mean, I hadn't seen Ed in a moment, and so it was really lovely to spend time with him. And the chateau, we kind of inaugurated the first in a series of see, is that the sirens, is that going to be a problem, or do we not
nope.
give a shit? Okay,
we don't care.
Okay, so it was the first in a series of these so-called literary salons that the chateau is going to do on monthly, and it was moderated by another old friend, Angela Jenklo, and kind of put together by Angela and Andre Balazs, who is the owner of the chateau. So these are all people I've known a very long time. And it was a lovely sort of freewheeling talk with Ed and myself for about an hour. And so I was happy to do that.
But yeah, that's sort of on home turf. So it's like a comfortable...
Truly.
Yeah, it's nice. I mean, it's nice when you can get that.
Totally. I had written a book called The Chrysanthemum Palace, and even forgotten, The Chrysanthemum Palace takes place, a huge part of it takes place at the Chateau Marmont. Mm. And the actual hardcover of that book, if you remove the slipcover, the actual hardcover was a painting of Ed's called... When Crescent Heights meets Laurel Canyon. And it was exactly that, just down the street from the chateau. The Crescent Heights stops and Laurel Canyon Boulevard picks up. So it was a lovely kind of nexus for me and revisitation of the chateau and my old friends, particularly Ed.
How is he doing? He's got to be getting up there in year. Ed Ruscha's got to be. How old is he?
He's about 86, but yeah. You know, he's been at the pinnacle of his career for so many years, and last year with that massive show in New York, and this year he had a huge retrospective at LACMA that opened about 2 or 3 weeks ago. So he's as vital and alive and productive as ever.
That's amazing. We should all be so lucky.
Yeah, and we will not be.
Probably not.
Yeah,
I was talking to somebody recently about how few artists really truly get a great late period. I mean, a lot of them, it's not pretty at the end, you know. So it's great to hear about somebody that's having one, you know.
Yeah, there's a number of them. Leonard Cohen comes to mind.
Sure. Yeah.
Yeah. Where there's a lot of new material generated and an overall sense of kind of a joyful elegy, you know. Yeah, and Ed certainly is one of those.
Yeah, I feel lucky I got to see Leonard Cohen on one of the last tours. Not the last one, but a couple before maybe. And it was just uncanny to understand that that one man down there on the stage had written all those songs. It
Yeah.
just didn't seem real, you know, even though I was watching it with my own eyes. Yeah.
No, I hear you.
So I'm thankful I got to see him before he kicked off. And yeah, I'm trying to remember. I'm pretty late to your work. I think I probably became aware of it because of the David Cronenberg movie, honestly. And that got me to read Dead Stars, which I really loved, and I kind of have been working through them since. And then I think I reached out to you because of the Marvel Universe. I wrote you, and surprisingly, you wrote back, which doesn't happen. It happens sometimes, but I don't. I was surprised. I'll say that to hear from you, because yeah, I don't know if you had this. I'm sure you've had this experience. You know, you write somebody a fan note, and that's fine. That's what it is. You know what I mean? You don't expect an exchange, but you wrote
Well,
back, and you know,
it just depends on the vibe, you know.
of course.
So the vibe was good. So there you have it.
Yeah, and yeah, it's been I've very much enjoyed getting into your writing, and I haven't gone chronologically. I've kind of gone here and there. Like, I'm right now halfway through Force Majeure because I found an old a nice old hardcover copy at a bookstore here. And that's been really enjoyable to go through again, and also just rewatched Maps to the Stars a couple of nights ago, to refresh my memory. But yeah, it was a great experience watching that movie the first time. I was at a nice old theater in Chicago called the Music Box. I was sitting in the front row with my friend Irvin Welsh. It was the two of us basically on an afternoon screening, not too many people in there. And it was just a joy to watch. Did you have a good time with Cronenberg on that? Did you have a lot of
Oh,
input, any input at all, or a lot?
it was I had known David for a long time, maybe 20 years before we made that movie, and I remember I was at the movies coming out of the theater when he called to say that he had just spoken to Rob Pattinson in Cannes, where they were for Cosmopolis, and Rob had said, without reading the script, that he would do the film. And with David, that film, I think it was almost 10 years before we were set to make. And he had gone to New York and interviewed Julianne Moore, and she signed on. And David, I think, wanted to shoot the entire film in Los Angeles, but it was prohibitive to do that in terms of what the cost would be. So the movie fell out, and David made maybe three or four movies, Eastern Promises and History of Violence. It was over. And then I got the call from him from Cannes, and within a very short period of time, the film was being made. And David and I were close, so most of it was shot in Toronto. So of course I went to Toronto and just watched and enjoyed. There's not much input one gives with David because he thought through the movie so diligently. There were occasionally some things in the script that would come up that I would ask him, would he like to replace this or that? But he's very respectful. He's a writer himself of the writing, and the script supervisor would watch the actors and listen to them like a hawk. And if they dared say left out a the, they would approach David and tell him that this or that person had left out a the. And David would then say, let's redo it or let's not. So it was tremendous fun for me and a privilege, obviously. And then we shot for a week in Los Angeles, which I think cost $1 million.
Right.
Which was not a small amount of money for a film at our budget. So it was joyful. And then the whole experience at Cannes is always an excitation.
Yeah.
And we had already left when I got a call. I was in Monte Carlo that, because David was already had flown back to Canada. And Julianne, we learned that Julianne Moore had won Best Actress. And so I returned the 45 minutes back to Cannes and accepted the award for her on stage, and then flew to New York and gave her the award, which was the first time she had won Best Actress at Cannes. So all of it was kind of a Cinderella experience. And then I, like Bud Wiggins, the protagonist in many of my books, I was back in the dungeon, sweeping the dungeon of the castle here in LA.
So yeah, that seems to be the tension, the kind of yo-yoing tension of so much of your work, like these connections with these big deal people, and then you retreat back to a humbler existence.
Yeah, the phantasmagoria of fame and fantasy, you know, when they collide. So, yeah.
Yeah, my only kind of personal connection to any of that world is my friend John McNaughton, who's a filmmaker who lives here, and he told me that you guys may have crossed paths because he had an office at RKO for a time. At some point, he was out in LA. He was making stuff, and you guys may have met. But he tells me these stories about all these this. The million and one projects that are this close to happening and then just fall apart because of unseen reasons and forces. And it all sounds like a fairy tale to me all the time, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. It's the same as it ever was in Hollywood. I mean, to this day, I know people that have made deals that will, and that they, a primordial part of them knows will never come to fruition. But
right.
Like back in the days of cocaine, when you think that the dealer is your soulmate, your best friend, going to go on forever, it's the same thing. You make a deal, you get the check, and then you're dead in the water, but don't know it.
So have you ever been at a point of not wanting to bother with it at all, that part of it? I mean, the Hollywood part of it?
Well, I'm at that point now, you know.
Yeah.
I mean, unless something comes to me, I don't really solicit things anymore. My life, like many writers here in Los Angeles, was always about the pitch. But that stopped for me. I don't have any interest in that.
Yeah, the other thing personally that I find baffling is just the level of how many cooks are in the kitchen, how many voices you have to deal with. What seems completely like a non-starter impossibility to me personally is how many people you have to listen to or get feedback from, how many people are involved in any of these productions, no matter how small. I mean,
the writer who has a thought or an idea to get to the point where your agent or your manager or somebody gets you in a room with someone that is capable of making the decision, it just it's almost an impossibility.
Yeah.
If you do get into that room, you'll be talking with people that cannot make that decision and whose job is to respond, react, and then communicate their desire, if they have it, that this project should continue to move upstream. But all of these things are fraught with you know, the odds become so stacked against one, unless you are a name. You know, I mean, Mike White doesn't have this issue,
Mm-hmm.
or if you have an overall deal,
Right.
which they used to hand those out, but that's a different time for certain. So in my case, if something comes to me and it's more European than it is American, people that know my work and are attracted to the extremity of my work, and those are the people that will are more likely for me to engage me in some kind of writing activity or development, But otherwise, this idea of me taking meetings is farcical, at this point in my life.
And I mean, when you started out, was like an early goal to make movies or to write books, or was it just writing, whatever that was?
Well, I always thought of myself as a writer. I was working in bookstores when I was very young. When I was 11, 12, 13, I was stealing books, hundreds and hundreds of books. And my heroes were writers. And it was Henry Miller. It was Jean Genet. It was Beckett. I had very good taste at a very young age. And then in my mid-20s, I met a woman who had knew people in the film business, and we pitched something. At the time, I was selling ink and toner, for copy machines over the in boiler rooms, just this sort of quasi-legal activity. And so we wrote a film, and it was made, 9 months later, and the director was impaired because of drugs, and the film never came out, which in a kind of direct and oblique way fueled my creation of Bud Wiggins. This character was drug addicted himself, and a perennial failure whose fantasies were being thwarted by a kind of cruel, bitter reality. So that, that early failure was actually good for my work. And then I think that for about 5 years, I was writing scripts and getting paid well for a 25-year-old in the 80s, but it was terrible hack work. And I began to write prose, short stories, to offset the kind of anguish that I was going through and whoring myself, and then I wrote short stories, which a friend of mine published in a desktop venture, and we called them Force Majeure, the Bud Wiggins stories, which were my version of Fitzgerald's Pat Hobby stories, but were brought further. I went much further than Fitzgerald's either sensibilities or the tenor of the times that he lived would have been acceptable. My stories ended often with pedophilia, and they were beyond the pale. So, but those short stories got attention. We sold 1,000 copies of them out of Book Soup, and then I got a book deal to make a novel out of those short stories, which I did, the book that you're reading now, the hard copy of Force Majeure. But I kind of came full circle a few years ago when I had written the Marvel Universe, and that book was canceled by the publisher, in essence, even though they didn't have the guts to tell me that, because of problematic language, the woke virus term, which means the book was censored by sensitivity readers. And Sam Wasson, the wonderful film historian, chronicler of Hollywood film, has a publishing house, and they did a limited edition of the Marvel Universe, and that was only sold out of Book Soup. So it kind of came full circle for me, my beginning and the work toward the end of my career.
But you, I think you've said in other interviews where like you got the most surprising responses and the wide responses for that than you had more so than the previous books or
What, for Marvel
different,
Universe?
yeah.
I don't know if that's true. I think there was more of a story behind it, perhaps. I don't know. I just don't know if that's true. After that, I did Roar, which was a fake oral history. And that too had difficulty getting published until I found a rather fearless publisher, because Roar, the protagonist of Roar, was a biracial older man that decided to have gender reassignment surgery in his 60s. And the fact that I'm a straight cisgender male, older, writing about a character like that was taboo, not acceptable politically. So that no novel, Roar, which got a lot of attention on the East Coast in terms of publishers. There was a one of the big publishers on the East Coast wanted to do it, but the moment it got kicked upstairs by this executive, who was an executive, he wasn't a functionary, he was a made guy over there, it was decided that Roar was problematic. So that's when Tony Lyons, my publisher, stepped in at Arcade and published the book, probably the most beautiful hardcover that I've ever had done of any of my books. And they're publishing my new novel, which is two novellas, The Met Gala and Tales of Saints and Seekers. And they're also reissuing, I think, nine of my paperbacks over the next 6 to 8 months.
I saw that the covers look really good, at least for the few that I could find online for the
Yeah, they'll have
reissues.
all those soon. Those are the classical paintings, is that because they,
With the paintings, yeah.
they're stunning covers, just beautiful covers. And yeah, so I have in essence a publisher for life, which probably is helpful to any writer. The idea that my work, which is has never been mainstream, has never had a huge following, that the very careful and specific work that I do that is so extreme, I don't have to look over my shoulder, I don't have to look in a rear view mirror and wonder if what I am writing will be published. It simply will be, as long as this publisher has blood running through his veins. So that's very important for me, because I'm not sure, you get to a certain age and you don't have the energy, certainly not to look for a publisher. But the Marvel Universe, that I released that myself into the public domain online, I probably would do the same with a book if I didn't have the publisher now, and probably would do the same, I would imagine.
I wrote a review of Roar. I don't remember if I sent it to you or not, but
Oh yes.
So I've definitely I've been reading the later books as they come out since since the Marvel Universe for sure. And how does where did the Met Gala, did it come out of sort of the same soup or whatever, the same work as a roar, or was it a separate thing afterwards? Did you
No, no,
conceive of
no,
it?
no. When I finished Roar, I started circling thoughts of what I might do next. And I thought at the time that there would be two books that I would write next, separate books. One would be a novel called The Met Gala, which would be a kind of operatic hardcore book. Dead Stars, if you remember, was divided into sections, clean and explicit, right? And so this would be an explicit book, which would be about almost mirroring something that happened during the Gilded Age. It would be about a woman, a very wealthy, influential woman, who had been disinvited from Anna Wintour's Met Gala, and in revenge, decides to have her own gala on the same night that Anna has hers, but on the West Coast, not the East Coast. And it would be a family melodrama. And that was a book that I was considering writing. Another book that had possessed me in the same way that writing an imaginary oral history had was a book that I ultimately called Tales of Saints and Seekers. One of the genres that I return to often in my life for solace are spiritual parables. And those parables, this in the past 2 years, the ones I returned to mostly were not Buddhist or Zen parables, although there were many of those. There were also the folk tales, the Japanese folk tales of Lafcadio Hearn, but they were Sufi tales compiled by Idris Shah. There's 10 or 12 volumes of Sufi tales, and they are quite stunning. Some of them are novels in themselves, even though they are a paragraph long. So much like I decided to write an imaginary oral history of someone that didn't exist in Roar, the filmmaker and protean artist Roger Orr, I decided that it was necessary and important for me to write an imaginary anthology of tales that were Sufi-like, tales of wisdom, humor, and tragedy, that mirrored or mimicked those you would find in collections or anthologies of spiritual parables. Then I thought, somewhere along the line, I thought, how can I sustain a 350-page novel about the Met Gala? Because I was not in the mood to write another Dead Stars. And then I also thought, how can I sustain a 300-plus-page novel of spiritual parables? Because none of those collections are of that length. They're all like 200 pages, 220 pages, etc. So then I got this kind of flash notion that I would combine the two. In my work, Dimitri, as I'm sure you have grasped at this time, my work is a combination of the sacred and the profane. And usually those two things are threaded together to form a kind of collage or quilt. In this case, it would be the first time where the sacred and the profane were divided in half, clearly divided. There was no confusion over what was sacred and what was profane. The Met Gala was profane. Tales of Saints and Seekers was sacred. The other thing was, I was going to reverse the order, and the first section was going to be under the general heading or subheading Antidote, and that was going to be Tales of Saints and Seekers. And part two was going to be Poison, the Met Gala.
Oh, so you were gonna
And
give us the cure first and then
that's
the
right.
disease.
That's right. But then, I was thinking, the more I thought about it, I felt that People misread or misunderstand my work quite often, and they think that I am the dark Hollywood satirist, and they ignore or minimize the aspects of the sacred or the magical in my work. And so I thought I didn't want to, I wanted to lead with the familiar, something that would draw them in, at least most of the people that spark to my work, and then hand them Tales of Saints and Seekers. The it's funny, the people that read this book understood instinctively how to read it, that Met Gala should be swallowed whole. It's something almost, if you read it in one sitting, that would be optimal. Tales of Saints and Seekers, which is comprised of maybe 60 very short stories, you can read one or two, three, maximum a day. A friend of mine who was going through a difficult time said he got great solace and almost would weep reading Tales of Saints and Seekers. And I have to say that they gave me great solace as well. I can still read them now as if I hadn't written them. They were given to me. They've joined a kind of anonymity. There's an anonymity to those tales where I don't feel like an author anymore, which in fact I'm not,
So yeah, when we're talking about how you were saying how often your work is often misunderstood, that you're this like dark chronicler of like whatever the underbelly of Hollywood. But I mean, one of the things that's always attracted me to your writing is you clearly there's an empathy, no matter how monstrous these people are. I don't know. There's this feeling that that you're not necessarily reveling in their decrepitude, or you're exploring it, but you're not judging them or casting, I don't know.
Yeah, I mean the idea that writers are always writing about themselves is accurate, because you're writing about what it's like to be human. So in order to embrace all aspects of that, you have to be looking at the sacred and the profane. So it is my worst imaginings often. And but the worst imaginings, the more extreme and appalling and nearly and anarchic and nearly pornographic or boldly pornographic are those imaginings, the closer one is to the celestial, to having that epiphany. There's a very thin membrane between heaven and hell. So I really try to reflect that in my work. When I say misunderstood, it's a kind of an awful word to use because it carries with it a freight of self-pity, and which is not, that's not how I'm feeling. I feel that on the glossiest, most superficial level, one could see my work as a satirical reflection or indictment of a certain culture. But I am from here. I don't consider myself someone that critiques Hollywood or film. That is in my DNA. I was raised in Beverly Hills and Hollywood. So that's, it's not something that I would set out to do. That idea disgusts me. But so I do write about the yearnings and the depravity and the yearnings of human beings toward the sacred, and that we are mired in earthly things that we walk in mud, zombified. It doesn't have anything to do with the purity of the yearning of all human beings. That's my feeling. So that is my life's work, really, is to show the admixture of those two things and hope that there's an alchemy that works that leaves one at the end, let's say, of one of my books, kind of breathless at the complexity and of what it is like to walk this earth on two legs, the complexity of emotions and the dreams and nightmares of that comprise what it is to be human.
So where would you put Dax Coldstream in in your pantheon of terrible fathers? He's got to be up there.
Yeah,
He's one of the worst, I
he
think.
yeah, he reminds me, God, I'm trying to think of, I think it's still holding the father of the protagonist, who was a film star that suffers a head injury when he's assaulted at a liquor store on Sunset Boulevard. He was a practicing Buddhist, and then the Sangha or the Buddhist community rallies around him, but through a series of peculiar circumstances, he is legally assigned to live and recover with the father that had tortured him as a child.
That's one
And
of the
that,
that's one of the ones I haven't read yet. Still
yeah,
holding, yeah.
that father ends up killing his girlfriend. That's a monster, a sadistic monster father, so yes, Dax Coldstream is certainly up there, but receives his retribution,
He does, but yeah, the one scene in Switzerland where he just kills the woman just basically for fun because he wanted to feel what it would be like.
Well, it's more
And,
than that. It's his mother hatred as well. Remember, he was looking for a woman that
Right. It
looked
was.
quite a bit like his mother, and
Yes.
he had a lot of mother issues, as they would say. But nevertheless, yes, the cold nature, which even took aback the paid assassin that protected him, who was there. He was taken aback, Moshe, by it. Is notable. So he's one of the worst, for sure. And yet, even writing him, you have to look at the parts of him that might possibly inspire empathy. His relationship with his children. You see his vulnerability there, but all in all, it doesn't excuse anything in terms of his behavior. His abysmal and terrifying and psychopathic behavior.
And I, for me, it's always been in pretty much all your writing that I've read, the saving grace or the however monstrous they are, they're felt sort of from the inside, not judged from on high. At least that's not the sense I get reading it.
Yeah, I hope so. In other words, I really mean it when I say that there are aspects of myself in every single character that I write, and any writer worth his salt does the same thing, because otherwise you're describing, you're not embodying, and that's pointless to me.
And so what about well, especially in Roar and in Met Gala, one of the central themes is this trans thing, the gender reassignment happens a lot. Is that a thing that you just wonder about, or are there personal connections that you wanted to explore by going back to that theme?
No, I'm just a culture vulture, you know. So what is happening now is something that I'm compelled to explore. And the whole idea of gender is has always been of interest to me. In Roar, you know, you had him in his late 60s transition to female, and then he decided that that was a mistake, and the reason he felt that was a mistake has nothing to do with what someone might think upon hearing me say those words. Which means that you know, you have a tremendous debate now and controversy around transgender surgery, and you had doctors that perform that surgery asserting that it has never happened point blank where someone regretted their decision, just point blank. And then you have others weaponizing that or politicizing it and saying, well, people that talk about those that regret their decision are really out to get those who transition in the first place. And in my scenario, Roger Orr was angry with himself. As he got approached death, he realized that gender was an absurdity, and that this idea of so identifying with such passion with gender was a terrible miscalculation in terms of a spiritual being and where one is going at the end of one's life into the unknown, into the unknowable. To go dressed as a woman or a man was completely irrelevant. And that's why he regretted his decision. But he knew that was too subtle and sophisticated a reason to have regrets. That no one would understand that. People are not capable of understanding that. People are very black and white, not just around the trans issue, but around all issues. That's human nature. There's a fundamental ignorance and fear-driven ego protective mechanism that is endemic to us all. So he simply said, out of a kind of a rage that was kind of rapscallion, you know, that he just a way of thumbing his nose, he said that he was reversing the surgery just because he knew it would stir up the those in the trans community and the LGBTQIA community. It would bother and annoy them, and that made him gleeful. So what he did do is he had his implants removed, but he kept the bottom surgery. He wasn't going to go through doing any of that again, but he lied about it all. So because he knew at the end that it was meaningless, it was farcical. The amount of energy and effort that's put into assigning gender was farcical and meaningless.
Do you have any friends that have gone through transition?
I don't have friends, you know. It would be unusual for me unless I had younger friends. But I do know trans people who I really, really respect. And Harry Dodge is one, married to the writer Maggie Nelson, who's actually in the Met Gala. In researching one of my books, I spent time with Zachary Drucker, who's a wonderful trans artist and writer. Tonight, I have a good friend, John Early, who's a brilliant
comedian and actor who is in a film called Stress Positions, who's directed by a trans femme artist and writer, Theda Hamill. So I'll be moderating a discussion with them. So, to be trans to me is just another, it's an essential part of being human. It's just another aspect of it. And that was Roger Orr's feeling that it was gender was irrelevant. Clearly, Roger Orr is not the ruler or god of the world. And that was his feeling. But Jan Morris, for example, is a huge part of Roar. Jan Morris was trans femme writer, born with male biology, and was a soldier and became an extraordinary and prolific writer. And she plays a very large role in Roar. And I would never have the audacity myself, Bruce Wagner, to say Jan Morris or Theda or Zachary or anyone was engaged in some meaningless activity, because I don't believe that. I don't believe that. But in terms of my closeness, do I have a, I know there's some family members of friends of mine, close friends, families who have transitioned. It's these are people in their 20, early 20s, which is much more common. Although in researching Roar, there have been people in their 70s that have transitioned. It's not something that it's anomalous, but it does happen. And I looked into that while I was writing Roar.
No, I ask because I have a friend who's just about the same age as Roger Orr, who was doing this. Is
Is
is go is
that Lucy Santi?
exact exactly Lucy Sant. Yep,
Yeah.
that's my friend, and so that's my first personal friend who I've known people in passing and just in town, young mostly as you say younger people, doing that,
No,
but.
that I really I obviously thought of Roger Orr when I read that about Lucy Sante. Someone that I admire. Both genders, I admire them, and I was very impressed with that, and very moved by it. So I really do in my work reflect. I try to reflect the zeitgeist, and often things come up. Not that I'm the ruler of the world either. But things then echo what I've done.
Yeah, of
There's
course.
Dante echoing Roger Orr, and I'm sure Lucy wouldn't see it that way. But I, that makes me feel, in essence, that when you're doing something from when you get out of the way, when a writer gets out of his own way and empties himself enough to let things come in, you get affirmations of these things. As you're writing a book and in the wake of writing a book, you get affirmation from from so-called reality, which is to me is as much of a dream as what we call dream life,
The other thing that the Met Gala and the Saints and Seekers book kind of brought to mind is the work of Joe Frank. Did you ever follow his work, the radio guy, Joe Frank?
I know about him, but I never really followed his work.
Well, the thing that it reminded me of is so a lot of his stories were kind of dark, kind of noirish relationship kind of gone wrong stories, also set in LA largely. But then he had this other side where he would air clips from a Buddhist teacher named Jack Kornfield, I think.
Cornfield? Yeah.
Yes, him. So there's this kind of yin and yang, these two sides, a little bit the way that this new book of yours works.
Oh,
So
what
that was
would you
an
recommend that I read of his?
Well, it's all audio. It's he's
Oh,
there's
it's
a web
all audio.
Pretty much. I think he published a few things, but really his primary medium was this kind of like radio, kind of like Dark Night of the Soul kind of
Yes.
freeform
Now
radio.
it's coming back to me now. So is that something I could find on YouTube, or is that serious or what?
I think there's his own website. I think it's just hisname.com, but
Okay.
you can track him down. I got to see him do a live show. He died a few years ago. He wasn't in good health, but it was kind of an amazing thing to watch. Making.
I will look that into that. Thank you for that,
Of
Dimitri.
course. Of course. The other thing I wanted to ask was, at least in the last few books, you have many, many, so sort of like quote unquote, we're talking about reality, quote unquote, real people, like real movie stars, et cetera. How have a have has have you ever gotten pushback from any of them for doing what you do? And B, how do you kind of choose, pick and choose which ones to plug into your stories?
Well, this is something I've done early on with all of my work. And I think perhaps Dead Stars was the first time that I think I made celebrities such as Michael Douglas actual characters in the book.
Right. I guess that's what I'm asking about.
I think in Marvel Universe, it was Billie Eilish. There was a whole group of people, but I think in terms of the legality of it, if you the standard that they use, a court would use, is can a reasonable person, a reasonable reader, assume that this is the work of fiction? Is there any chance that a reasonable reader could pick this book up and think that it is somehow a true non-fictional account? So we really look at it that way. Does it pass that kind of test? And then the other thing is that I have no intention ever of dragging a real person through the mud. I just don't work that way. There's no reason for me to do it. So when I have real people, it's for verisimilitude. It's not, for no other reason. I'll have cases like, I think still it might be from Still Holding Again, where there's a girl that looks that is a celebrity lookalike, looks like Drew Barrymore, et cetera. So all of my work has that. I've never, I think only one time did I have to remove something, and if it were today, I would not do it. I wouldn't agree to do it. It was one of my books. I had a celebrity waiting outside a shrink's office to be the next patient, and even though this celebrity had written in about want about enjoying th psychotherapy. The lawyers sometimes are just absurd, and they said, well, she lives in New York. New York has different libel laws. If she lived in California, it would be all right. Just madness, madness. But that was just one time. And in fact, another time I had someone object. There was in I'm Losing You, there was a famous dermatologist here in Beverly Hills named Arnold Klein, who's now dead. And I had made him a character. I based a character kind of on him that only people that knew him would have recognized, changed the name. And I had someone confront me at a party and say, how could I have done that to Arnie? You know what I mean? But it doesn't happen too often. In fact, it's the opposite, where sometimes I'll get approached at a party or a gathering by someone that says in a half joking way that they'd love to be in one of my books. And I often I like to oblige them in that case, in a lovely or friendly way. You know, again, when people ask me, are my characters based on anyone in real life? Well, the Arnie Klein thing is an exception, which of course I built upon. It wasn't like a portrait of Arnie Klein.
Yeah.
But I don't do that. I have no interest in that. You know, it's like in being Irving Wallace or whoever it would be.
Yeah.
Judith Krantz, that would,
yeah.
This is a thinly veiled portrait. You know, I don't,
yeah.
It's not the way I work. I don't operate that way.
No, I wasn't wondering about the legality of it, more as an aesthetic choice, I guess, like to use these real people in.
Yeah, it has to be the right kind of mixture, Dimitri. You know, it can't be someone too obvious.
Yeah.
Or it has to be a glancing encounter, like again in Dead Stars, the little girl who has the youngest mastectomy patient in right. the country, who is obsessed with the Kardashians. It's often much more interesting to me, the kind of sideways backdoor obsessions, than it is to have a kind of up close and personal front row celebrity that is, quote, starring or co-starring in one of my works. Mostly they're background noise, you know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's very it contributes to the reality of it, the lived in feel of these books. I mean, at least for me, that they're just part, like, this is part of the flora and fauna of the environment that you're creating, that
yeah, precisely
based on a very real thing.
Yeah.
And yeah, I've very, very much enjoy. So what's will you do any sort of book tour type things for this new book? Do people even do book tours anymore? I wonder.
They do, but it's kind of on a very large scale. I'm probably have a kind of a book party here in LA, and probably one in New York. But for the most part these days, you know, one does what I'm doing now.
Exactly.
You can talk to people that you like. I've always liked you and your work, aside from the fact that you were a fan of mine, but the books that you've done and sent me are just little works of art. And that really impressed me. Yeah, they're so beautifully designed, and it's something so unusual. So, you know, I have the chance of having a longer conversation with someone have an admiration for than usual. And then you do online interviews, and which are always best, because you can get questions and then craft your answers, and you know, so I'll just do the usual gamut of stuff, you know.
Yeah, I've only ever been on one ill-fated book tour. It was actually to the West Coast. It was about 10 years ago, and I don't know if that'll ever happen again. But I'm also, at this point, like you say, I'm making these books that are basically just art with some words around them.
Yeah,
I'm making them myself, and there's no distribution. You know, you have to get them from me. So
yeah,
there's not an institution that would fund my going all over the country. You know what I mean?
No, and they're kind of useless. Ill-fated is a good phrase for it, but nothing ends well, Dimitri. You know that.
Yeah. You know, some things end well. You know, it's nice. One of the nice things about the current technological environment is that we can have a conversation like this that's kind of free form, and the length of it and the subject matter is kind of up to the two of us, not up to any other gatekeeper or what have you.
Yes.
And I'm a very big fan of this podcast form, you know. I'm a fan of that for that reason. I think that these kinds of conversations can happen. And I wouldn't have ever dreamed of this as a possibility, you know, 10 years ago, even, you know?
Yeah.
which is an amazing thing. And well, that's probably good a place as any to cut this off and let you go.
Well, thank you, Dimitri, for your time, and it's lovely to speak with you.
Likewise.
In this kind of free-ranging manner. It's always enjoyable. All right, brother. I really appreciate it, and keep in touch as always.
I will. I'll probably be in LA at some point because my baby brother lives in Redondo Beach. So I'll be out that way at some point.
Well, give me a shout. We'll have a coffee or a meal, okay?
That would be great. I would love that. Thank you very much.
All right, my friend.
Talk to you later.
Bye.
Bye-bye.